Today on Pilot's Discretion, we're joined by flight instructor and flight simulator expert Josh Harnagle. He tells us about losing the engine in his Bonanza, training with flight simulators, and the best Texas barbecue. Pilot's Discretion starts right now. Hi, pilots. I'm your host, John Zimmerman of Sporties, and thanks for listening. Remember to visit sporties.com/podcast for show links and complete archives, and send us an email with your comments or guest ideas, podcast@sporties.com. Today, I am joined by Josh Harnagle, a 3,000-hour multi-engine instrument flight instructor and vice president of marketing at Redbird Flight Simulations. He is one of my go-to guys when it comes to flight training because he's done almost everything. He's been a frontline instructor. He's worked with large flight schools. He's helped launch aviation programs in K-12 schools. And he hosts the annual Redbird Migration Conference. Josh also owns a beach bonanza, so he knows the practical side of flying very well also. Josh, welcome to Pilot's Discretion.
Thanks for having me, John. This is great. I'm a big fan of the show, so it's nice to be on it. And I'll say I'm honored because I've been going through your guest list in the past, and I think I'm far below the standard, so I appreciate it.
Oh, I don't know about that. We'll see right away because I want to ask you about your engine failure, memorable flight last year, memorable for the wrong reasons. You were en route to Sun and Fun. The engine quit in your Bonanza. Before we get to the aftermath and the lessons learned, and there's a lot of really interesting ones, I think, tell us briefly what happened.
So we were flying. It was me and two passengers, both employees of Redbird and both pilots, thankfully, flying to Sun and Fun on March 28th to go man the booths there at the exhibit. And I was up at 15,000 feet. The airplane is turbo normalized. And I saw a reduction in power. So I should be at about 30 inches and I was at about 11 inches. Felt it in the airplane and then confirmed it on the manifold pressure. Kind of long story short, the turbo failed in a way that allowed the oil in the engine to exit the tailpipe. And so recognized a little slower than I should have, but recognized that I had an engine that was about to seize and went through all the machinations of that, diverting and trying to make it to an airport. And then along the way that ends up happening is once it starts seizing is that the crankcase will split open typically because a rod will come out because the piston gets stuck inside of the cylinder. And then there's some oil in that crankcase still. And then that oil gets on the exhaust and it looks like smoke. And all of a sudden you think, oh no, I'm on fire. And so you ended up putting the nose down, losing some altitude, unfortunately, putting me in a position where I couldn't make an airport. I didn't take too long to recognize what was happening, but put me in a position where I had to land in a field in a cow pasture outside of Newton, Mississippi. We got down safely and no damage to the airplane other than an engine that was now a paperweight and no damage to any people or anything. So that was worked out for the best, but it was definitely a sporty day of flying.
There's a video of the landing online, which we'll link to in the show notes here. It's incredible to watch. You did a phenomenal job handling the emergency, it should be said. A lot going on there, and the end result is absolutely, as you said, turned out about as well as it could have. But one of the things that struck me is how quickly it all happens. And people talk about, you know, time slows down in those situations. Is that true? I mean, put us in your head. What's going through your mind in that situation?
Yeah, very much. It was, I can't speak for everybody, but for me, I got very, very narrow focused, very kind of mechanical, just working through the problem that was in front of me and trying to, you know, what's the next thing? What's the next thing? What's the next thing? It's kind of nice to know in that environment, in that situation, I don't panic. You know, I know that for a fact now, but it was not the kind of thing that I never really had a strong emotional reaction or even really thought like, this is it. I mean, I did have a brief moment right on downwind turning into base where I didn't really have a lot going on. I had the runway made and I knew it was going to happen where I thought, man, it's going to be sad not to watch my kids grow up. But, you know, that was really, it was just a sort of a matter of fact thought. It wasn't There was no emotion tied to it. It wasn't really until I got on the ground that, you know, all the gravity of the situation, I guess, hit.
There's an incredible quote you wrote in an article reviewing the incident. You said, "This is not a binary event. It's not like you have an engine that's fine one moment, then seize the next."
Yeah.
And you talk about how the whole process is more violent than you anticipated. And it seems to me that's not really what we train for. The classic training is, boom, your engine just quit. Where are you going to land? And it's a much more easy to diagnose situation. What's your lesson for us, given your real world experience?
I think that's very true. And, you know, specifically in this oil starvation, and then the engine seizes, it's a thing that happens over a couple of minutes. And in my airplane, like at six cylinders, there's a lot of torque in there. There's a lot of metal. And those pistons start, I mean, they fuse to the cylinder because the aluminum melts faster than the cylinder, and you know, everything's expanding a little bit differently. And so individual cylinders will stick before others will. And the prop is still driving. You know, the fuel may be shut off. There's no fuel, there's no spark, but the prop is still being pushed by the wind. And I can't feather it because I don't have oil pressure. You know, that force creates a lot of the violence. I mean, I ended up having some screws in the instrument panel back out. Honestly, my first thought was, man, I'm worried the engine's going to come off the mounts. But it is definitely not straightforward, you know. And in thinking back on it, you know, as soon as I saw the oil pressure was down, I knew immediately what was going to happen. I knew the engine was going to seize and that I would be dead sticking it somewhere. But it wasn't, it doesn't happen like it does in training, where it's just sort of quiet and, okay, now we get to pick a landing spot and, you know, make sure you make your turn to base, you know, all that stuff. It's way more fluid than that. And there's, you know, there wasn't, I can't define a point where I said the engine stopped producing power here. It was kind of mixed, you know, it sort of happened in a gradient versus a single event.
Yeah, I've heard some instructors say they like to practice a partial power failure on takeoff. That's an especially important time, obviously. And it's not often just you take off, the engine quits, boom, we're landing. There's more room for error. So I think that's definitely something for pilots maybe to think about on their next flight review, is to simulate a scenario like that.
I fully agree. I mean, if you think about all the different ways that an engine can fail, or you can lose partial power, most of them are going to be in a kind of a prolonged situation. I mean, even, you know, pre-ignition or anything like that, it's going to be one of those things that happens over a series of a couple of minutes. It's not sort of a just single point in time.
Something else you wrote really struck me. You said, quote, "It's the hope that kills you." What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so it's one of those things that, you know, that in my airplane, a loss of manifold pressure like that is oftentimes or most likely caused by an induction hose coming off. And so the airplane basically goes from turbo to normally aspirated, and it's really not a big deal. It's more of an inconvenience. You have to land and biomechanic to reattach the hose. And so my immediate response was, oh, that's what happened, is that we lost an induction hose. It's no big deal. It's divert to Meridian because I think there's better mechanics there, which is one of those things looking in hindsight is ridiculous. You know, you got to get on the ground. And I mean, I will say the POH is pretty clear about that. You know, they say it's probably this, but it could be these other really bad things. So just get on the ground as soon as you can. And it's probably a little goes even beyond that, in the sense that I have Smart Glide in the airplane. And so I have a little blue ring on my PFD that'll tell me how far I can glide. And if it wasn't for that, I probably would have tried to make the airport I was originally going to, because it was, I saw it. I mean, I could see it. It looked right, you know, based on judgment, it looked right at the edge of my glide. But I had math in front of me that said, you're not going to make it. And it's one of those things that if I didn't have that, I might have hoped that I could have made the airport. And instead of just 5,000 feet, 7,000 feet, whatever it was, picking a field and committing to it, I would have tried to make the runway and would have ended up in the trees.
Unbelievable lesson there. That was a real eye opener for me when I read that, because I fly with Smart Glide as well on a, you know, Garmin GTN. And I've always thought of it as a technology to help me make an airport. But what you illuminated for me is it's actually as valuable the other way, a technology to tell you you're not going to make it. So don't try to stretch the glide and stall it at 100 feet and spin into the trees and turn a forced landing, which you demonstrated can be completely survivable.
Yeah.
Don't turn it into something much worse. So that's a fantastic lesson. Anybody flying with some of that Smart Glide technology, even something in ForeFlight or an EFB app, use it both ways. Don't try to stretch it. You mentioned the successful landing, and to me, a great piece of this is the happy ending, not just the safe emergency landing, but about 6 months later, the airplane's flying again. So tell us first about actually the process of getting the airplane back in the air, and then I want to hear about you as a pilot getting back in the air.
Sure. So that they don't really talk about that in training is what happens when you put it in a field. So what ends up happening is you call your insurance company, and they hopefully you have a good insurance company, and they have an endorsement to on your policy to pull it out for you. And they contact a company, a guy, in my case, a gentleman named T.W. Cook, who was excellent, who came, took the airplane apart, takes all the fuel out, takes all the oxygen out, takes the wings off, tail off, all that, and puts it on a trailer and takes it to a shop, which is what we did. We found a shop nearby, relatively close, and got it there. I ordered a new engine from Ram and had that delivered. I will say it was painful, not Ram, but the getting the airplane back together took a lot longer than I anticipated. But it did get back together, and we did, and then picked it up in the first week of November, I believe. As far as, you know, there's a lot. I mean, in this case, I had the new engine, which is its own thing. You got to worry about, you know, infant mortality and maintenance-induced failures on the engine and, you know, and you got to break it in, so you can't, you know, you're not going to do a lot of ground runs and all that kind of stuff. So once you commit to go flying, you've got to go flying. But I also had wings and control surfaces that all got disassembled and had to be reattached and checked and balanced and all that stuff. So that, you know, that was quite daunting, the first couple of hours in the airplane, to really, both from a, you know, there's a lot that has to happen that we have to do and some requirements we have to maintain for the engine, but also just that getting back in an airplane that I was not necessarily super confident in. And I'd had 6 months, you know, of not really being, certainly not flying that airplane and not doing a lot of flying in general. I mean, I personally, I tell my kids, you know, I really force the issue with my kids. Anytime they fall down, they get back up and they try it again. And so it was, I think, a week after the incident, I went up with an instructor and did a flight review. And then I think later that month, I did an IPC. Now, I wasn't in my airplane, but it was just the act of getting back up and flying again, I think, was important, and not letting myself stew on it, really. And getting back into it. And I'm sure we'll talk about it some more, but I've flown the sim more in the last 6 months than I've flown it previously for personal training, than I've ever flown it. And, it was super helpful. When I got back in the airplane, I was confident in my abilities. And so I could focus on the airplane, and not be worried about whether I was going to be able to shoot an approach if I had to, or, you know, execute it good leading or anything like that.
Is there one habit in particular that you've changed as a result of this? Something you do differently when you fly that Bonanza now, whether it's pre-flight planning or emergency checklists or anything like that?
So two things, really. I am very active in looking for off-field landing spots. You know, I've always, you know, it's always a thing that you think about and consider, but I'm now to the point where I look at Google Maps of the airport that before I take off and say, okay, if I lose the engine at 200 feet, if I turn 20 degrees right, there's a field that's over there, or maybe there's not a good option. and I'm going to go for this river or these this area of trees where it's little, you know, those look like pine trees and not oak trees, whatever, you know, and really go through and write it down. I actually have a scratch pad that I keep in ForeFlight that's my options on this runway. And I do that now before every flight. And then I watch the oil pressure very closely.
Understandably.
Yes, I pay quite a bit of attention to that gauge. So, yeah.
Let's talk about IFR flying for a minute. This is a passion of mine. And I know it's yours too. You and I have traded notes on this. I feel like not enough instrument pilots really feel confident enough in the clouds to use their rating. They sort of pass the check ride and are proficient at it, but they quickly lose that and they don't really feel great using it in the real world. And you told me recently in an email, quote, "I think standard instrument training does a terrible job preparing both GA and professional track pilots." So what do you think we should do?
Yeah, so it comes from the fact, I mean, I use my airplane as close to an airliner as I can get, right? It's if it's legal and safe, I don't have any ice, so I got to avoid that, but I try to go. That requires the pilot needs to be good, needs to be really on it, and on it in the system in which we operate, not necessarily the way we train. And the standard instrument training is you go out, shoot three or four approaches, one after the other, and oftentimes at the same airport, so the weather isn't changing, and the runway alignments aren't changing, and you're not really transitioning from the cruise environment into the approach environment, and you oftentimes are not transitioning from cruise into a vector to final. I'll actually was on a flight coming back from Batavia. It was ended up being night IFR, kind of bad weather, and I've gotten some vectors for diversion, and there was not a clear transition from ATC whether I was being vectored en route or being vectored for the final, and they ended up giving me a really tight turn into final, heading to intercept, and I didn't have time, or I didn't click in my head to sequence the autopilot, and so I ended up going. I was watching it. I mean, it ended up flying through the course, and I turned back and got on, you know, before I got, you know, more than a needle or a single ball of deflection. But it was one of those like, here's the thing that is not really an issue you'd have to worry about in training, because a lot of times you're shooting full approaches. You're you know, it's kind of rare that your instructor will simulate vectors. And in the 172, your approach speed and your cruise speed is like, 20 knots apart and very easy to get down. As you advance in more, you know, higher speed, higher performance airplanes, the difference between your descent or your cruise speed and the approach speed is significant, and it takes planning. And I don't think we do a really good job of teaching what it's going to be like in the real world. When you've flown for 3 hours, and you're tired, and you got to shoot this approach, and it's totally different than the en route environment that you've just spent 2.5 hours in. I'm not saying I have the world's greatest solution to that problem, but it is one of those things that I think if you are a newly instrument rated pilot or a pilot that doesn't fly instruments very often but wants to, the key is to fly IFR cross countries as much as possible, even if it's VFR. It may be a little more work. And, you know, I know some people are really hesitant to do that and they'd rather just fly VFR. But if you're going to use the rating, you got to get out and in the system and what it's like to talk to ATC and, you know, request approaches and all that kind of stuff. That I just don't think we do a great job of on the flight training side.
Yeah, that's great advice, because I think IFR flying is really about going places. And it's not about a discrete procedure that we shot this approach and it's over. That's not IFR flying. It's the whole thing. So flying those trips, like you said, is so key. And even one of my things, when I'm doing instrument proficiency flights, there's a tendency to say, well, let's go do the full thing and let's do the hold. And, you know, I haven't done a full procedure turn in real life in a long time. So why don't we train like we fly like we train. Let's go do vectors, maybe even get a short turn on because the controller's having a bad day, because that's exactly what happens in the real world.
So. Yeah, it turns you in short and high, and you're fast. What do you do? I think that's way more accurate. And as far as holding goes, I think the only time I've gotten a hold in real IFR flying has been en route for sequencing. And that's not something that they're going to, you know, that we talk about very much in training. It's not a hold on the approach. It's some waypoint before you get there.
I have two real holds in 28 years of flying and 4,000 hours. And yeah, one of them was en route to Dulles because I was the slow guy. So I agree.
Yep.
Josh, let's take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to ask you about sims in your day job.
Introducing the first premium apparel brand made for pilots and aviation enthusiasts. AeroWare combines modern performance fabrics with tasteful aviation styling, so you can show your love of airplanes whether you're at the office, on the golf course, or in the cockpit. Thoughtful details like UPF 30 sun protection and hidden sunglasses holders are perfect for active lifestyles. Visit AeroWare.co to shop the complete selection of golf shirts, button-down shirts, hats, and more. That's AeroWare.co. Now, back to pilot's discretion.
We are back with Josh Harnagle, who works at Redbird and thus is deep into the world of flight simulators. We've had many guests on the show, Josh, talking about how to use home simulators, but I want to first ask you about using sims in flight schools, because this is something that Redbird really is an expert at. So you do an annual flight training survey at Redbird, always interesting details there. One standout result to me from a recent one was that student pilots and instructors do not value flight simulators the same. The students and the pilots there for proficiency seem to see a lot more value than the flight instructors. Why is that and what should we do about it?
Well, I think, at the core, it's a structural issue, right? Most of the instructors are there to build some flight time and go on to another job, which that's the way it's set up. There's nothing wrong with that. Or there's nothing wrong with people that do that. And the student is there not to be, not for training, but to get a rating or a check ride or whatever they're doing. And I think sometimes there's just a mismatch between the instructors are there to provide training. The student is there to achieve a goal. And that goal is not necessarily to fly around with the instructor. So, the student is... Most students are open to the idea of using tools that will help them achieve their goals faster. And the instructors are more hesitant because they're not getting the same incentive. You know, the incentive structures are a little bit different there. We have a flight training program here at Redbird where we have paid for our employees to get their license. And whenever they start, I always sit them down and say, okay, you are the owner of your training. The instructor is there as a teacher and keep you safe, but you have to own your training. And that may mean you go in and say, no, we're using the sim today because I need to work on these things. And unfortunately, that's kind of the way we're set up right now in the industry.
And I think it's important to point out that maybe in the old days, sims were considered, well, that's something you do for instrument training. You know, we'll go shoot approaches in the box. But modern simulators, even we're not talking full motion, even basic simulators can be valuable for primary training as well. Is that correct?
Yeah, fully. I mean, we subscribe to and have used at various points when we had our own flight training operation the idea that all training, private, instrument, commercial, everything, the airplane is a terrible place to learn. And so we don't learn anything. We don't introduce anything in the airplane. We always do it in the sim first. At least get the procedures down, understand what the airspeeds and the power settings are going to be, what's the checklist flow, all of that stuff. The sim is just so much better at it because we don't have all the overhead of burning fuel and also time overhead of getting out to a practice area. In a nutshell, the easiest way to integrate a sim into training is just do everything in the sim first and then go do it in the airplane. And that may mean a 15 or 20 minute sim session before you go out to the airport or out to the ramp to get in the airplane, but it's super effective.
How do you use a simulator personally? You obviously not for primary, you're using it, as you mentioned, for proficiency. What are some habits or rules you've developed over the years?
Yeah, so I'm lucky. I have a Redbird MCX 20 feet from me right now that I can go use anytime. So I get that not everybody is in this position, but I my general policy is I will fly every approach at an airport before I go to that airport. And if it's an airport where they have departure procedures or an arrival procedure that applies, I'll try to fly those as well. Typically at 2x speed, so I'm not sitting there forever. But I think it's important to at least familiarize myself with the procedure that I'm going to be flying before I go into that particular airport. It doesn't happen all the time. I mean, I also have an airplane to be able to take spontaneous trips and, just get up and go. But that's my goal, is to fly every approach at the airport before I get there.
How often should a pilot who's maybe flying 50 hours a year VFR, so it's not an instrument currency thing, how often do you think they should fly a sim, even if it's just a home sim?
If they're flying 50 hours a year VFR, I would say at least once a month, maybe more. Maybe once every 2 weeks they should go out, because, my personal number is about 100 hours a year for me to really feel like I got it. And maybe 150, 200 is ideal. And so if you're at that 50 hour, I think you need to supplement that time in the air with sim, because if you're using the airplane for any kind of travel, even if it's just getting lunch at a nearby airport, 40 of those 50 hours are going to be sitting there watching the airplane fly. So you need to spend some time doing the things that are important and that will actually get you.
Josh, we always finish with our ready to copy segment. So I'll throw out some questions on a wide variety of topics and you fire back with your quick answer. You ready to copy?
I'm ready to copy.
You wrote that, "I have a pet peeve with the concept of safety in GA. Basically, I think it's a verbal crutch that subconsciously allows pilots to avoid coming to terms with the risk inherent in flying a small airplane. What's wrong with the word safety and how we use it?"
Okay, so GA is not safe, right? I mean, technically, walking is not safe. If we want to say safety is about avoiding all risk, we're not doing that. I think it's important to talk about improving safety. But really, for pilots, it's about risk management. The activities we do are risky. We need to accept that risk and try to understand it and manage it and reduce it as much as possible.
You wrote an article about your own personal flying policies, and one of them was to fly with a CFI at least once every quarter. Why is that?
Well, I think it's especially as you get more time and experience, and you if you own an airplane and that's the airplane you fly primarily, you can build really dangerous habit patterns out of convenience or, whatever the system may be. And so it's important to bring somebody in to the airplane that can watch you. It's not necessarily about I need to learn an ILS or I need to learn how to do steep turns. It's more about I'm going to go out and do these things and I want you to see what I'm doing and provide me some feedback on it. I mean, the biggest thing for me is checklist usage. It is hard for me. I have flows, but I get very comfortable and I will do the flow and it'll be 20 minutes later that I go, "Oh man, I got to make sure I set up my airplane for a cruise," right? And pull up the checklist. I ought to keep that a little bit closer. So the CFIs can really help with that.
Somebody once told me that you need to have someone in life who can call BS on you, both in life and in flying. I think it's great advice that you get real comfortable and you need like you said, once in a while, go flying and say, "Well, this is how I do it." And you need some type of relationship there where that flight instructor can say, "That's good that that's how you do it, but that's not right."
Yeah. So. And I'm lucky. My dad's an instructor. I work with several instructors. So they got a good close personal relationship with them and they can call my BS for sure.
You also talk about having a written goal for every flight. What's an example of a goal? Say, as you said there on the, "I'm flying to the next airport over for lunch." What's a written goal for a simple flight like that?
So I'm a huge believer in there's no such thing as a perfect flight. And a written goal for a flight like that might be I'm going to manage my airspeed across all phases of flight within one knot. So if my climb out speed is 120, my cruise speed is blah, 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 I want to get it just as precise as possible, even on a VFR flight. And so you can find everything in that flight can be improved on probably. And I think it's important to focus on them one at a time.
What's the biggest marketing mistake you see flight schools make?
Not answering the phone. I don't know that that's marketing, but I mean, that's the biggest one. I mean, I know this is supposed to be quick, but when I got out of the airplane and I was trying to schedule my flight review in March to get back flying again, it took me a week to find a flight school that would answer the phone and get back to me.
Wow.
Not a great start for a valuable customer relationship. How about on the flying or the training side? What's the biggest mistake you see flight schools make from more of a curriculum or flying standpoint?
I think we don't teach the idea of being a PIC early enough. And that the CFI ends up being PIC in terms of decision making way too long into the training. You know, once that pilot's able to fly straight and level, they should be making some decisions.
Great answer. What's a simple lesson you can learn in a simulator that most instructors don't teach?
How to enter the traffic pattern efficiently. You know, if you've ever been a flight instructor, you've wasted many hours of your life as someone flies around an airport trying to figure out how to enter on the 45.
What is something you should never do in a simulator? Or at least something that's not valuable in a simulator?
If you are learning how to land an airplane, I would not do that in the sim. You can do all the procedures up to it, but the actual gut feeling of I'm going to land, don't do that in the sim. And I would also throw in their spins, probably. That's a thing you need to be in the airplane for.
You own a Bonanza, so I have to ask, what is the best Bonanza model ever made? I know this might start a war. There's strong feelings on this, but what do you say?
Okay. Out of the factory, the best Bonanza model would be an A36 from the late 90s, before the G1000, personal preference. And then the best model ever made is mine. It's the B36 TC with the turbocharged with the Tornado Alley turbo normalizer IO550 STC. It's got 102 in the wings and you can fly forever at 200 knots.
Are you prepared for the hate mail from the VTOL Bonanza crowd?
I am. Yes. Yeah.
All right. You live in Texas. I was born in Texas. Texans have strong feelings about barbecue, among other things.
Yes.
So where, in your opinion, is the best place in Texas to get some authentic barbecue?
Well, it's probably not controversial, actually. It's Snow's in Lexington, Texas. They've won the 50 best barbecue a number of times, and they are only open on Saturdays until they run out. It's the really classic non-commercialized barbecue, but it is excellent.
So you're a traditionalist. I respect that. Our last question is always the same. You have one final flight. We want to know, what are you flying and where are you going?
So I thought about this a bunch, actually. And I think for me, flying is really about family. Like I said, my dad's a flight instructor. I was my wife's flight instructor. That's how we met. Her dad's a flight instructor, uncles and grandpas that are all pilots. So my last flight, ideally, would be sitting in the back with my wife, with my two kids, Jacqueline and Paul, up front flying the airplane.
Sounds great. Once again, as we always find on this podcast, it's about the people as much as the destination. Josh, thanks for being on the podcast.
All right. Thank you, John. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to Pilot's Discretion, brought to you by Sporties, training and equipping pilots worldwide for over 60 years. For more episodes and today's show links, visit sporties.com/podcast. I'm John Zimmerman. We'll see you next time on Pilot's Discretion.